Well, they say you know you've really made it in life when your name appears as graffiti. Apparently, if you've really made an impact on people, and then a good way of discovering that is that you'll get your name or your picture scribbled on a wall somewhere. I sort of wonder if that's just told by school teachers to make themselves feel better when they glance at the toilet walls, and then we get referenced. But we sometimes think graffiti is just a modern day phenomenon, but you've got a picture here of some graffiti dating back from the 2nd century AD, discovered in Rome on the Palatine Hill. And this is actually the first surviving picture of the crucifixion. And it's been cleaned up a bit, but it depicts a man stretched out on a cross with the head of a donkey on him and another man kneeling in worship. And scribbled underneath those words say this. They say, Alexamenos sebete theon, which translates as Alexamenos worships his God. Now, we don't know who Alexamenos was. The building this was founded was almost certainly a school for like royal servants in Rome, training young boys to be servants. So it's a fair guess Alexamenos was probably one of the pupils. He was a young Roman servant. And it's also a fair bet that one of his contemporaries drew this on the wall. And so from this, you could deduce two things. Deduce that Alexamenos was a Christian, he trusted Jesus, and his friends mocked him for it. It's really striking. The first picture we have of the crucifixion is graffiti, making fun of what happened. What we learn from that is the crucifixion of Jesus, when it happened, was not something you depicted in fine art. No painter ever painted a crucifixion until a long time after societies stopped crucifying people. You wouldn't want a record of a demeaning death like crucifixion. We're used to seeing pictures of the crucifixion from the Middle Ages, Renaissance, up to the present day. You didn't do it when you actually saw people crucified. Actually, graffiti would have been seen to be about the right level for the death of Jesus. And again, for someone to worship a man on a cross is just madness. It's like worshiping a donkey, the artist is saying. Fast forward nearly 2,000 years, and the cross of Jesus and the insistence of Christians to worship Jesus for dying on the cross is still seen as something both baffling but also just crazy to people. Again, 1979, Monty Python released their film The Life of Brian. Again, seen to be one of the best British films ever made, a really insightful comedy, kind of parodying organized religion in general, Christianity in particular. And again, if you've seen it, it is actually a very funny, well-done film. Very insightful in the comments it makes. And it famously ends with a depiction of the crucifixion of the main character, Brian, surrounded by other people singing a song, "Always Look on the Bright Side of Life." And the director, Terry Jones, later on in a documentary I saw, was defending that scene from people saying it was blasphemous. And in essence, his defense was this: well, it wasn't my idea to put the crucifixion front and center. That's Christian's idea. If you've got a problem with crucifixion, he basically said, take it up with Christians. See, for Terry Jones, it was a horrific thing, but he's making fun of Christians who worship Jesus for dying on the cross. And even within the Christian church, there have always been voices saying, let's not talk about the cross as much. It's just baffling to people who don't get it. Most recently, Christian leader Steve Chalk, in a 2003 book, The Lost Message of Jesus, sort of made that point very forcefully. He basically said, we can't keep talking about the cross as Christians because people don't understand what we mean. So he basically says, if you tell someone, describe to someone in the street what was happening at the cross, Chalk argues what people actually hear is this, that the cross is a form of cosmic child abuse, a vengeful father punishing his son for an offense he has not even committed. Understandably, both people inside and outside of the church have found this twisted version of events morally dubious and a huge barrier to faith. And so Steve Chalk's solution is, let's not major on the cross as much. Let's find other aspects to talk about. Let's just put the cross to one side because it just doesn't help anyone. The cross of Jesus, it's always been mocked and it's always been misunderstood. So what are Christians to do with it? Should we follow Steve Chalk's advice and just stop talking about it as much? Maybe major on other things, maybe the miracles of Jesus, the teaching of Jesus. Why not play it down? Well, again, we need to take our lead as Christians from how Jesus himself talked about and understood the cross. Again, the message of Christianity we've seen throughout this series in John over the years stands or falls on the person of Jesus. So what did Jesus think was happening at the cross? We may have lots of different ideas, lots of different problems with it. What did Jesus understand was happening at the cross? And that's actually what John 12 helps us to see a few chapters before Jesus actually goes to a cross. So if you were here last week, you'll see that John 12 takes place. Jesus has arrived in Jerusalem for the Feast of the Passover. It's a matter of days before he's going to go to the cross to his death. And verse 20, if you saw in our reading, some Greeks arrive. They ask the disciples, "We want to see Jesus." And then Jesus seemed to take that as a trigger to start explaining to the crowd and to these Greeks what is about to happen to him. So, verse 23, Jesus replied, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." Now, up to that point, Jesus talks about the hour quite a lot in John's gospel, but it's always something happening in the future. So back in John chapter 2, Jesus turns water into wine. He says to his mother, "My hour has not yet come." John chapter 7, people try to arrest Jesus, seize him, but they couldn't lay hold of him because John says his hour had not yet come. But now, Jesus says in verse 23, the hour has come. And the hour has come for him to be glorified. The Son of Man is how Jesus refers to himself. "This is the moment I am going to be glorified," Jesus says. Now, I don't know what you think about when you think about glory. I generally think about cheering crowds, a scene of real triumph somewhere. So again, you think Andy Murray winning Wimbledon, surrounded by cheering, adoring fans. You think about a political party maybe having a landslide victory back in 1997, Tony Blair swept to power, huge crowds celebrating that day. See, glory, to us, it's all about victory, success, coming out on top. And again, you can think about Jesus' hearers here going, "The hour has come for him to be glorified. This is it. This is where Jesus becomes king, kicks the Romans out, and makes Israel great again." But then verse 24, Jesus begins to explain what it means for him to be glorified. Verse 24, "Very truly I tell you, unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds." See what Jesus is saying there? He's saying, the moment you're going to see my glory is the moment I die. That image of a grain of wheat falling to the ground. A little later, verse 32, Jesus is even more explicit. He says, "And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." Again, you see the footnote in our church Bibles. The Greek for lifted up means both lifted up, as in physically. That's the death Jesus is going to die on a cross, on a beam of wood. But also lifted up means exalted. You're going to see my glory. So for Jesus, the hour of his glorification is the hour of his death. And that is very baffling to us. Because again, there's so many other candidates to see Jesus' glory. Choirs of angels at his birth, that's pretty glorious. Calming a storm with a word is glorious. Walking on water is glorious. Raising a dead man like Lazarus is glorious. And yet, Jesus says, if you really want to see my glory, the hour is coming when I'm going to be lifted up on a cross. And he knows that will be baffling for us. So he actually wants to explain to his hearers why the cross is the time when he will be glorified. So first of all, we see Jesus' glory at the cross because Jesus died to give us life. That's verse 24 in front of us. Because basically the big problem we have with violent deaths is basically they just seem so pointless. They just seem pointless. So someone dies in a car crash, or maybe in a school shooting, or murdered by a family member. And what we think about is, what a waste. We will never get to see what that life would have developed into, who that person would have become, what that person would have gone on to do. It just seems pointless. It's a waste. And that's how many people sometimes think of the cross of Jesus. Here's a fairly young man in his early 30s. He's achieved so much. He's taught so much. He's done so much. And yet he's convicted of trumped up charges. The charges are false against him. And he is executed. That is a waste. It seems pointless to us. But Jesus says no. Verse 24, he says, "This is the reason I came into the world." And the image he uses is of a grain of wheat. Yeah, it's a striking image, one that all his hearers would have understood. A grain of wheat is designed, it's created, in Jesus' terms, to die, to fall into the ground. Because when it's in the ground, it will produce many seeds. It will bring life where before there was nothing. And similarly, Jesus says here, "I am like that grain of wheat. I entered the world. I became a man. I traveled to Jerusalem for the Passover in order to be lifted up, in order to die on a cross. This is the goal my whole life has been leading towards. The hour has come," Jesus says. And that's a really powerful image for us understanding Jesus' death. Because we live in a world that is starving. People all around us are hungry, and they are hungry for many things. They're hungry for meaning. They're hungry for love. They're hungry for acceptance. They're hungry for just a reason to get up in the morning. And actually, every single one of us knows what that hunger feels like. We have all shared in that hunger, and we seek to satisfy in any way we can. But actually, in the process, we just end up hurting ourselves and hurting other people. We can never satisfy that hunger. But you realize, in a time of famine, a grain of wheat is so precious, unbelievably precious, because that's where the food comes from. That's where life comes from. And Jesus says he is that grain of wheat in a hungry world. He is the one who has come to satisfy our longings for acceptance, love, meaning, purpose. And he's going to do that by dying for us. Earlier in John's gospel, in John chapter 6, Jesus described himself in these terms. He says, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty." How do we see Jesus' glory at the cross? Because he came to give us life, the life we were created for, Jesus says. And another reason we see the glory of Jesus at the cross is because Jesus shows us who our God is if we're Christians. He shows the God we believe in is God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit. Specifically here, he shows us that the Son and the Father are absolutely one in what's about to happen. So look down at verse 27. Jesus begins with these words. He says, "Now my soul is troubled. What shall I say? Father, save me from this hour." Again, there's a danger if we just talk about the glory of the cross. We forget the cross was horrific. Jesus didn't relish going to the cross. He knew the cost of the cross would just be unfathomable. The physical suffering of being whipped, being struck, being spat on, being nailed, slowly suffocating. And then in addition to that, the fact he would be cut off from his Father in heaven. The other Gospels describe that cry of dereliction, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Jesus is troubled by this. But actually, at that very moment when he's contemplating what it's going to be like to be cut off from his Father on the cross, ironically, he shows us just how united he and the Father are at this moment. Verse 27 again. What shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. No, it was for this very reason I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name. Then a voice came from heaven. I have glorified it and will glorify it again. The cry that was there and heard it said it had thundered. Others said an angel had spoken to him. Jesus said, this voice was for your benefit, not mine. Got an amazing moment. This voice from heaven speaks to Jesus. It happened twice earlier in his life, at his baptism, this is my son whom I love, with you I'm well pleased. At his transfiguration, this is my son whom I love, listen to him. And again, at this moment, God the Father speaks into this world clearly to say, we are united on what is about to happen. And why do we need to hear that? Because actually, when we think about the cross, it is so easy for us to caricature it. To see the cross as somehow, in the words of Steve Chalk, this vengeful father punishing an innocent son for a crime he had not committed. For that reason, Steve Chalk said we shouldn't even talk about the cross. He used that horrific phrase, cosmic child abuse. Is that what's happening? Well, no. The father and the son show us here. They are absolutely one in what is about to happen. God the Father and God the Son are both committed to Jesus going to the cross. And that was what makes them a glorious sign of the Trinity, of the God that Christians worship. So at the cross, God the Father gives up the most precious thing he has, his only Son, whom he loves, for us, that we could be reconciled to him. And at the cross, God the Son willingly lays down his life to bear the wrath of his Father and to win our forgiveness. The Father and the Son are working together, these verses show us. They are working as one. There's no disunity there. And that's why we need to realize the cross is glorious, because it reveals the love that the Father has for us in sending Jesus, the love the Son has for us in going to the cross, the love the Father and the Son have for each other, in working together so closely to bring glory to their name by lavishing grace on us. We're getting an insight here into the close relationship between the Father and the Son. And they tell us that they are going to receive glory from what is happening at the cross, because at the cross, Jesus died to defeat evil once and for all. Again, all those images of glory we had earlier, actually, they're not out of place when it comes to the cross. In spite of the horror of what happens, there is a victory taking place when Jesus talks about his hour coming. And again, it's an amazing irony. At the cross, it looks like the world is judging Jesus. But Jesus actually says something different is happening. Verse 31, look down at that for a moment. Now is the time for judgment on this world. Now the prince of this world will be driven out. See, the cross, we think the world's judging Jesus. The world's condemned Jesus to death. Actually, Jesus says, I'm judging the world. And at the cross, we think, well, maybe has the devil won as the prince of this world, that description. Has he finally beaten Jesus? Well, no, actually, Jesus says, that is my victory over him. Jesus turns our understanding on its head. The cross was Satan and sin's greatest defeat. And again, we live in a world that shows all the signs, the thumbprint, if you like, of the prince of this world. Why is there so much evil around us? Again, the situation in Edinburgh this weekend is just horrific. Why do the closest human relationships sometimes just break, betray one another? Why can we not love one another? Why can we not forgive one another? Because we live in a world under enemy occupation. We live under a world where the devil claims to have control. And therefore we ignore God, we reject God, we think, well, God doesn't love us, so why bother with God? But see, the cross is Jesus' judgment on that lie. If we think we're all good people, we need to look at the cross and say, that's how serious our sin is. That's how messed up and broken we are. But also, if we think God doesn't love us, if we believe that lie the devil tells us, God's abandoned you, we look at the cross and we see God has not abandoned us. God loves us so much. He entered our world and took our punishment on himself. The cross was a victory over evil, over Satan, Jesus says. It was a glorious day. And that image of cheering crowds you might have had earlier, Jesus actually goes on to tell us who those cheering crowds are going to be. Verse 32 here. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. Jesus says he will draw all people to himself. What does he mean there? Well, sadly, actually, it doesn't mean that every single human being is going to trust in Jesus' death on the cross. Even later in this chapter, we see people stubbornly refusing to believe in Jesus. But what Jesus is promising here, by all people, he means people from all nations, from all over the world. This whole account began with some Greeks coming to Jesus. Greeks were never accepted by Jews, but here they are accepted by Jesus, as are his Jewish disciples, as are people from every nation and tribe and language and religious background. Jesus died to draw people from all nations, all people, to himself. And there's a huge encouragement there for us, but also I think a huge challenge for us if we claim to follow Jesus. Because we live in Leicester, and Leicester is an amazing city. It is so diverse and plural and multi-ethnic, multicultural, that actually we often draw boundaries in our minds, don't we? A little aerial shot of our city. We kind of think, Jesus, he maybe died for certain people in Leicester, but not for all people, because that would just be a bit offensive to suggest that. But again, Jesus says he has come to draw all people to himself, regardless of age or gender or religious background or ethnicity or social background. And Jesus wants to use his people in that process of drawing all people to himself. So the last few months in our family meetings monthly, we've been thinking about the north of Leicester, parts of Leicester that are unreached, thinking what part might we play at Avenue in partnership with other churches in reaching unreached parts of our city? I think we're all finding those uncomfortable conversations to have. It's daunting thinking about this. But actually, if we're going to take Jesus at his word here, he is calling all people to himself, people from every background, people we might just not bother with, cancel out, just dismiss. Jesus wants to call all people to himself, and he wants to use us in that process. Are we going to take Jesus at his word at this? Because that is how he's glorified, as people from all nations put their trust in him, put their trust in his saving death for us. So why is the cross the moment of Jesus' glory, when we think it is anything but glorious? Well, Jesus is beginning to explain to his disciples why that is. He says at the cross, he was dying to give us life, to give us food in a starving world. He was dying to reveal to us that he and the Father are one. He was dying to defeat evil once and for all. He was dying to call people from all nations to trust in him. That is why the cross is the moment where we see Jesus' glory, he tells us. And we shouldn't kid ourselves that the cross is pretty. We shouldn't sentimentalize it or sanitize it. It was horrific. And in one sense, it's right that we recoil, actually. We just don't want to think about it. But Jesus says, in the midst of that horror and that unjust death he died, he was bringing glory to himself by lavishing grace on us. And the world we live in is often going to be baffled, offended by the cross. The Apostle Paul talked about it being a stumbling block to Jews, foolishness to Gentiles. Back to that bit of graffiti we began with. Again, Alexamenos being mocked for his faith. And what sort of a God goes to a cross, Alexamenos? Haven't you heard of our gods? They're a lot better than your God. We can be sure Alexamenos suffered for what he believed. The mockery hurt him. But I always like to think when I see that bit of graffiti, here's a brave young boy from a low social class, and he's trusting in a God who has identified with him so much that he went to a cross to save him. I like to think of Alexamenos as he's mocked and misunderstood, taking comfort as he looks at the cross, as he looks at the character of Jesus. In some words from Isaiah 53, and then I'll hand back to Chris. Words about Jesus. He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain. But surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering. Yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him. And by his wounds, we are healed.
Thank you, Richard. We're going to spend a few moments in quiet thinking about some of these things. I'm going to put a few verses on the screen and just leave us some space to meditate on them. We've been thinking about the hour of glory and the cross, that it was done because it's how Jesus gives us life, to show unity, to defeat evil, and to draw people from all nations. There's some verses coming up that pick on that theme of glory at the cross. Let me read them to you, and then I'll leave a moment for us to meditate on them. This is taken from an incident where Jesus went up the hill, up a mountain with two of his disciples, and it's called the Transfiguration, where he met with Moses and Elijah, a kind of a mystical event. But it's really, there's an interesting detail that Luke gives us. About 8 days after Jesus said this, he took Peter and John and James with him and went up onto a mountain to pray. As he was praying, the appearance of his face changed and his clothes became as bright as a flash of lightning. Very glorious. Two men, Moses and Elijah, appeared in glorious splendor talking with Jesus. You can imagine this kind of cosmic event. And what were they talking about? They spoke about his departure, which he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. Why don't we have a moment of quiet to reflect that this is where Jesus showed his glory? Going to another passage in Scripture from the end of the Bible, Revelation, a famous vision that John had of kind of the whole of overview of history, and he writes this. There's some confusing images in this. It's a strange kind of story, this vision. But then I looked and heard a voice of many angels, numbering thousands upon thousands and 10,000 times 10,000. They encircled the throne and the living creatures and the elders. And in a loud voice, they were saying, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain," that's Jesus, "to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise." Again, we've got this glorious scene, and yet at the center of it was the Lamb that was slain. A moment of quiet again to meditate and bring our praises to this Jesus.